right? That naive ethnocentrism then grows up into a form of virulent bigotry. Something like that seems to me to be the phenomenon of, say, white supremacist groups in the United States. You've got people hanging on to their traditional beliefs and refusing to think critically, and thus thinking that people who think differently than they do, people who are different than them, are somehow dirty, wrong, just not good people because they're so different. Now, most religious beliefs in Western culture are not like the beliefs of white supremacist groups. And white supremacist groups typically do appeal to religion, as you probably know. But the great religious traditions of the West tend not to go that direction, right? Sometimes they're criticized as being inherently irrational and bigoted, but I don't think that's an inherent feature of these traditions, because all these traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have all incorporated practices of critical inquiry. Critical inquiry is part of these traditions, right? To take the Christian tradition, you know, critical inquiry into the Christian belief has long been an inherent feature of the Christian tradition. It's called theology, right? It's what Augustine did and Aquinas and all these people that we've been studying. Critical inquiry into the tradition is an intrinsic part of the tradition. And that allows the tradition, Christianity or Judaism or Islam, they all have versions of this practice of critical inquiry. It allows these traditions to react to challenges without bigotry, right? To take these taken-for-granted beliefs and make it like the kind of belief that we have in, say, using knives and forks, a belief you still hang on to, but one whose taken-for-grantedness is undermined, right? But it also goes further than this because, of course, these traditions believe their beliefs are true. And that crucial word true, is, as I raised in the last lecture, is something I want to get back to in the final lecture. But that's a crucial feature of these traditions, which I'm going to want to get back to. All right, but let's look now at the ordinary believer, right? Someone who's not a theologian, right? Someone who's not good at arguments, and think about that. But what I'm going to say about ordinary believers is not something that doesn't apply at all to theologians, say. Let me make a note about that. To be part of a tradition of critical inquiry means not necessarily that every individual can answer every possible question. Just because you're a theologian, say, doesn't mean you can answer every possible critical question about Christianity, right? Just because you're a physicist doesn't mean you can answer every possible critical question about physics. You're part of an overarching tradition which is used to dealing with critical questions, and where some people deal with some questions and some people deal with the other questions, so on and so forth. So you're no longer an epistemological individualist. You no longer have to figure out everything for yourself. So, for instance, here I am, a member of the Christian tradition. I think about certain critical questions, and they bother me, and I wrestle with them. But I don't wrestle with every question that comes down the pike about Christianity. That's someone else's job, right? This is a communal enterprise, an enterprise that's been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I don't have to sort of give an answer to every possible question. I don't have to prove my own religion on every possible point. I'm not an epistemological individualist. It seems to me that that's how it works for all individuals in religious traditions. At any point in time, any one of us who are members of a religious tradition may need to be able to reply to critical questions. It may be our responsibility at specific points to reply to critical questions, just like it may be a responsibility for a 10-year-old to say, okay, is there really a Santa Claus? Right? At some point, it may become our responsibility to answer these critical questions. But it's nobody's responsibility to answer all possible critical questions. Right? And in many ways, that's what was wrong with the epistemological individualism of Locke and Descartes, this notion that the individual was totally responsible for everything he or she believed. That's not the way it is, I don't think. And in this respect, I'm agreeing with the Reformed epistemologists. We are part of traditions. Our thinking is shaped by those traditions. And we rely on other people to help us do our thinking, to answer some of the questions for us. That's the way science works. Why couldn't it be the way religion works? Okay. So, suppose we look then at how epistemology looks in a bit more detail from this Reformed perspective. One of the reasons why evidentialism used to be taken for granted, used to be the position that everyone assumed was true ever since Locke really persuaded people that the evidentialist position was the right way to go.